Welcome to the Dialogue by Wirepoints, connecting the dots between our economy, government, and people. And now your hosts, Ted Dabrowski and Mark Glennon.
Hello, this is Ted Dabrowski from Wirepoints, and I'm with my partner, Mark Glennon. Thanks for joining us on the Dialogue. And today we have as our special guest, Steve Malanga. He is from the Manhattan Institute. And for those of you guys who know him, you know what an expert he is on state and local policy issues. And for those who don't know him, he's written lots of books. He's covered for years and decades lots of the problems in states. He used to be an executive editor of Crain's New York. He's written several books, and he's had a lot of fun, you know, looking at the good and the bad of what states have been doing over the last few decades. And so with that, we're excited to have him on because he can bring a perspective of where Illinois is relative to other states, you know, based out of New York, right, Steve?
Yep.
Yep. And you got New Jersey right next door. So you've got some interesting states that you cover right there. So why don't we start with, look, as we record this podcast, just yesterday, Mike Madigan, the nearly 40 years of speakership at the House here in Illinois, was indicted on 22 counts of bribery and racketeering. And that kind of encapsulates where Illinois is today. Lots of problems, lots of corruption. What is it you see? What should people see? Well, let me say one more thing. You know, Mark and I at Wirepoints, we beat up on Illinois a lot. We love this state, but we don't think it's doing the right things. We try to highlight its problems and try to provide solutions. What does an outsider like you see, especially when you know so much about other failed states and what other good states are doing?
Well, first of all, whenever I hear of a public official who's been in office for 40 years, I think that's a problem right away. And I'm not shocked when such a politician, you know, is indicted. Particularly, here's the guy who really generated a lot of controversy, a lot of heat, but it was impossible to get him out of office. He was so entrenched. And so that's a huge problem. I mean, you know, in some respects, whether you want to talk about things like term limits or just, you know, a political culture that in which voters say, well, enough is enough. You know, let's just move on. And then when you add to that, that in his 40 years in office, in a key position in the state went through such decline from one of the industrial powerhouses in the country, from one of the richest state governments in the country from the point of view of just being stable, financially stable, to one of the most heavily taxed, regulated, indebted states in the country. I mean, it's extraordinary. How can he not bear some of the, you know, a substantial amount of the blame for that after 40 years?
Absolutely, Steve. Mark Glennon here. And before I ask my question, just big shout out to the City Journal. We link to it often beyond Steve's articles there. They are great fact-based research pieces, not too long, not too wonky, really outstanding covering in large part the federal-state relationship too, which we've covered from the bottom up, sort of Illinois looking upward at the growing breakdown of federalism if we've had it. But City Journal has a big picture view of that, and Steve and others there have been looking at it from the top down, and I encourage you all to look at it regularly. Steve, we're going to go through some of the particular issues, but you know, as an outsider, and you look at a lot of states, give us your perspective about what in particular stands out about Illinois. I'm sure it's probably on the bad side, but what jumps out from you?
Well, first of all, one of the things that I tend to do when I do my writing is, you know, as you say, you know, I try to really stick as much as possible to the facts. And so, you know, I don't just like to say, you know, oh, look at that state, they did something crazy. I like to say, you know, well, where are they? What's their performance like? And the thing that sticks out with Illinois is consistently, no matter what you look at, in terms of economic performance, in terms of taxes, regulations, in terms of new businesses, new business generation, for more than a decade, Illinois has consistently ranked near the bottom on many, many measures. And if you look right now, for instance, people are now starting to look at the states and rank the states in terms of their recovery from the pandemic recession. And again, Illinois and, you know, most of the rankings that people are doing is near the bottom. There was one done at the end of December, is based on fall data, showed, you know, Illinois had gotten back about 60% of its jobs. California was down near them at 68%, but you had people at 80, 90%. We're now to the point where we know at least four states have completely recovered, probably more than that now. That was last month. So it's just, if you just look at the rankings, it consistently ranks in the bottom in so many things. And then you, you know, including things like out-migration, meaning people leaving, businesses leaving. And in this recent piece I wrote about, which I guess we're going to talk about, what kind of like, which is, you know, we titled pretty much the war between the states or among the states. You know, if you look at that, again, it's down at the bottom in terms of where people want to be, where businesses want to be, even if when you just ask people, you know. And so it's hard to escape that, because all of these rankings and all of these surveys, they can't all be wrong.
Well, Steve, you know, it's people like to blame the weather for people leaving Illinois. But, you know, Indiana has done exceptionally well. They've grown their population. Wisconsin has grown their population. They've done the big reforms.
Yeah.
So what do you attribute it to? You know, we just talked about corruption. Is it just such a corrupted place, or do you want to put anything else on it?
Well, first of all, when people talk about the weather, right? The thing is that Andrew Cuomo, for instance, in New York, would talk about how, you know, the older people when they retire don't want to live in the state because of the weather. But when you look at out migration, okay, in Illinois, for instance, there was a recent study done of out migration of millennials. And Illinois was like third worst in the country. They had so it's young people are leaving. I mean, is that really because of the weather? You know, so let's just kind of like keep that in perspective. Number one, I guess I kind of first came to the Manhattan Institute because when I was at Crane's New York Business, I was writing a lot about the power of public sector unions and their ability to shape an agenda. And I was writing about this about New York City and New York State. When I got to the Manhattan Institute, they brought me there to write about that. And I started looking all over the country and I saw that pretty much the same thing in a whole bunch of places, California and Illinois in particular. And you know, that is just inescapable. There are a lot of different ways to look at it. But I mean, I'll give you an example, okay, because it fits so many ways. I recently did a piece in which I looked at the amount of time that school children missed school during the pandemic by state. And guess how that actually ranked? The states with the highest level of public sector unionization and teacher unionization were the states where the kids missed the most amount of time. So over and over again, you see these correlations, right? And again, after a while, you begin to think there must be something going on here, right? So this is really a state that has, you know, gone not just Democratic, but it's really gone as a result of that wholeheartedly union and you know, again, another way of looking at it is look at many of the states with the worst pension problems, lines up almost exactly the same way with just a few exceptions. And there are reasons for those exceptions. So you can't really get away from this. You know, the real question then becomes, as a larger political question, faced with that, why do voters continue voting the way they do in the state? And I wrote a book called, which my publisher actually titled The Conspiracy Against the Taxpayers, right? In it, my opening essay was about how over time, what happens is when groups like public sector unions really get a hold of a political culture, they change the laws, they change the processes so that reform becomes very hard. And so even when you have a reform, let's say governor like Bruce Rauner, he is stymied in what he wants to do. And it's very difficult to change the culture. And so clearly this is something that is that has evolved in Illinois, very much like it's evolved in California and in New York and in New Jersey, to name just four places.
Yes, Steve, you're living the problem. Like we are, you're in suburban New York in New Jersey, which is right up there on many of the same problems, particularly pensions, property taxes. We're neck and neck for the worst places in the country.
Out-migration,
yeah. We'll ask you the question that we get so often from our readers and commenters here is, you know, why are you doing this? Is it hopeless? A lot of people think it's hopeless. We have a whole diaspora of former Illinoisans that are readers. And, you know, sometimes it's kind of hard to argue. Is it possible to turn these places around? I mean, realistically, are these problems intractable in your view?
Well, it is very difficult, but we tend to be optimists for this reason. We are located in New York City. I spent my career in the late 80s and 1990s writing about what an absolute mess New York City was economically, financially, and socially, culturally. New York City turned around. We had a lot to do with what needed to be done to save that city. And really from the mid 90s through to right up to the just about when de Blasio was elected in 2015, that's a pretty long run. New York City was a nice place to live with really, really low crime. Taxes weren't great, you know, but Giuliani had put the brakes on tax increases. Bloomberg only increased taxes once. You know, so things like, you know, in over 20 years, what happens is things kind of catch up, and it became a competitive place again. And it was an astounding place economically. I used to write about how New York City was stuck in a 50-year economic cycle where it couldn't break out of that cycle, and I would go through all the numbers. They broke out of that cycle after 9/11, right, and went to new heights, new populations. So it is entirely possible. I remember the New York Times, after Obama was elected, interviewing us about what role we thought we would have right now, you know, with because we no longer had a Republican president, and we had some relations with Bush, and you know, certainly some of the things like school reform that he did, we had been big advocates of. And the thing we said at that time is the template we have is look how great New York City is right now, and so we remain optimists that that kind of reform is possible. Now, it's never ending, because we're now, thanks to the pandemic and thanks to a strangely kind of progressive movement among young people, even New York is starting to be in decline again. Although it made such progress that the decline in New York relative to where it was is still reversible, if you will. So that's kind of where I am with all of this.
Yeah, that really was.
Steve, I'm reminded.
Go ahead, Ted. Go ahead.
No, Steve, I'm reminded that New York was almost in bankruptcy. New York City was almost in bankruptcy.
Yes.
Before
it
could turn itself around. And so,
yeah.
Insolvent.
It was insolvent.
Right. And so in a sense, some of us argue that that's what needs to happen in Illinois before we can actually get to reforms. It doesn't seem like we're going to be able to just, you know, flip things around and take back, you know, put people back in charge, not the unions, et cetera. But I think this is a good opening. You wrote a really good piece about War of the States and what some states are doing really well. And of course, you criticize other states who are doing things poorly, Illinois among them. Take us through how, you know, I argue that Illinois has lost its competitive mentality. It doesn't think in competition anymore. It just tries to do its own thing, and we lose people and we make a mess. Tell us how other states are doing things with regard to jobs and taxes, and you know, how should Illinois be thinking differently about these things?
Right. So one of the reasons I wrote that story is that after the 2008 and 2009 recession, there was Barack Obama was elected president, you know, on a taxing, basically, economic agenda. And states started raising taxes. And everybody thought, you know, remember those like, you know, like that time, was it that Time magazine cover, we're all socialists now, or maybe that was Newsweek, I don't know. You know, but what happened was the exact opposite. A wave of governors elected in 2010, Republican. The Republicans took seven governorships away. Over time, 900 legislative seats around the country switch from Democrat to Republican, and that whole tax and regulation agenda that seemed to be gaining momentum actually was reversed in the states. And what then happened is you had states like Texas, like Indiana, Ohio, which then began actively recruiting businesses and also residents from Democratic states. And they were, you know, really upsetting the Democrats. I'll never forget Mitch Daniels, who was governor of Indiana, as you know, until 2012. I mean, he was invited by one of the Illinois Chamber of Commerce's to cross the border and go talk to them in Illinois. And I remember he accepted that.
I was at that event.
You go. And I'll never forget. I mean, Daniels was such a character. At an event we had, I remember him saying, you know, being next door to Illinois is like having the Simpsons as your next door neighbor.
Steve, at that event, I asked him, what's the secret? What did you do to turn things around in Indiana? Without hesitation, he said, I stepped on the public unions. They were the problem.
Well, of course, he did. Yes. And in a piece that I wrote about this era that I'm talking about back in like 2013, I pointed out he was able in Indiana to sign an executive order. He found out that the power of the public sector unions to negotiate contracts came from an executive order. So it wasn't even legislatively entailed. And so he just signed an order saying, oh, we're going to stop this. Remember Scott Walker in Wisconsin, neighboring Wisconsin, he had to actually get legislation passed, and he did. And we saw dramatic changes in Wisconsin as a result of that. But what we've seen now, which I'm writing about, and which I wrote about in this piece you mentioned, is we saw suddenly, once it was clear that the pandemic was not going to drag the economy way down and that the tax revenues were not going to be anything like what we thought they were going to be in terms of the decline. People were talking about $200 billion in state tax revenues evaporating. And then, of course, all the federal money. Republican states started cutting taxes. In the middle of the pandemic, they're cutting taxes. I remember looking at a list. Someone said, oh, here's a list of states cutting taxes. I looked at it. The first thing I looked at, I said, I'm like, they're all Republican, you know? Meanwhile, I knew that New York raised taxes by $4.3 billion, even though they had a surplus and they had $12 billion in Biden stimulus money. They raised taxes by $4.3 billion because they said the rich weren't paying enough. So it had nothing to do with the fiscal situation of the state. It was more like just punitive. New Jersey raised taxes on millionaires. So, you know, it's clear to me that what we're seeing is almost a repeat of this era that began in 2010 and certainly went to, I would say, about 2016, and represented a stark contrast in regulation and taxation among the states. And Republicans made tremendous gains in that. One of the other things, of course, that they did during that period was five states passed, all Republican, passed right to work. Now, right to work means, of course, you can't force unionization on a worker if they're in a workplace that has been unionized. It gives people the ability to opt out. Right to work is all the studies show this, even the academic studies, right to work is a tremendous incentive that attracts businesses, particularly manufacturing businesses. And a good example, as I point out in the piece, is that Indiana passed right to work in 2012. Mitch Daniels had never made that a priority in his administration. He wasn't sure, you know, how important it was, but he admitted as soon as he passed it in his last year in office that he started hearing from businesses and he thought, wow, this is a big thing. And what happened was from about 2012 to 2019, the end of 2019, right before the COVID recession, in that recovery, Indiana added 50,000 manufacturing jobs, Illinois added 5,000 manufacturing jobs. So, what's the excuse? They're right next door to each other. So you can see the impact of some of these decisions. And again, there have been a number of studies which have shown since we now have more than half the states as right to work, clearly the right to work states are the places where big businesses are big manufacturing businesses are going. If you look at all these recently, just before Christmas, there were car manufacturers, Volkswagen, Ford, Chevy. They're all opening new plants in these places.
Yeah, and tell me if I'm right about this, Steve. They may be right to work, but they're not radically right to work. That is, you can still unionize in many of these places
if
you want
to. Well, that's right to work, yes. Right.
And in fact, I believe this is still correct. Indiana has added more union jobs than Illinois has. Now, that might just be part of a consequence of the growth in manufacturing jobs that you mentioned, but I think that's that's not unusual. That if you really got a problem with labor, you can still unionize. But
of course, what right to work says is you have the ability to opt out. But the ability to opt out is important. And what you say, I actually wrote a piece a couple of years ago called "The New Map of Labor in America," in which I looked at growth and decline. And one of the things I found that we kind of laughed about, Texas was right up there in terms of adding new union jobs. Now, as a percentage of unionization, the percentage was actually still declining in the state. The reason it was declining is Texas is adding so many jobs that even though they were adding more union jobs than other people, as a percentage of their total growth, it was smaller. But that phenomenon that you mentioned, that definitely happens.
You focused on some of the right to work private sector stuff. I always argue that's still a problem in Illinois, but the bigger problem in the whatever you want to call it, short and medium term, are these pensions. Are the public sector unions, and where you've seen some of the public sector unionization drop in parts of the country. I'm not sure it's dropped much at all here. We have a massive public sector union participation, and of course we give the unions the power to strike. We also, for those who can't strike, we give them the right to force arbitration. So we're on the extreme side of the power of the unions. Talk a little bit about some of those southern states. Well, it's not just southern states, but other states that limit the bargaining. You know, Wisconsin limits bargaining to just wages. Indiana cut back on a lot of the collective bargaining powers. Other states make it illegal. We're extreme here.
Yes, Ashley. And we are going through a period of extreme decline in public sector union members. I just, again, looked at the latest numbers and wrote a piece about that. Collectively, we now have fewer, I don't know if you remember, about 2008, we crossed the point where there were officially more public sector union members in America than there were private sector. And a lot of people made a big deal out about that. Well, that era ended quickly because the public unions have been battered by a series of recessions, and they're now down in this recession, and that continues to decline. And it's happening around the country. I think they're down below the level they were 10 years ago. So they've lost 10 years worth of gains, basically. But the thing is that in Illinois and in New York, places like that, you have such a concentration now that even though it's declining, they still dominate the public sector workforce in those states, whereas in other states it's diminishing so much that even where they allow collective bargaining, maybe 20%, 25% of the workers are part of unions, and they're much less friendly to that. And remember, I talked about this whole idea of the conspiracy against the taxpayer. One of the conspiracies is those groups that are in power passing laws that entrench them. And certainly we've seen laws passed in the wake of the Janus ruling, which, you know, came out of Illinois, in which the Supreme Court said you can't force a public sector worker to either be a part of your union or pay you a fee if they don't want to be part of the union. We have seen a further decline in unionization, but states like Illinois, states like New York, states like California have passed laws that make it harder to exit a union if you're in a union, you know, and so people are struggling. And there are some of these public interest law groups like the Institute for Justice that have been essentially waging lawsuits against these laws around the country so people can have the right to do what the Supreme Court said they are allowed to do, which is leave a union. And some of the laws are ridiculous. You only have 3 weeks in a year that you can leave a union. You have to tell them you leave. And by the way, if you tell them you leave, you want to leave, and they you know, after a month, they, you know, well, we never got your message. You know, well, I'm sorry, you got to wait till next year. This is what's been going on around the country. So in some places like Illinois, the deck is stacked against reform.
Yeah, that historical shift towards union power was illustrated only a few years ago. The late Adlai Stevenson III, who had been Secretary of State here in the late 60s, no conservative, obviously, but he said, you know, when I was Secretary of State, you had a bad employee, you fired him, and there was no problem. Now you cannot fire any bad performer in government, and that just one indication that, from an historical perspective, even from an honest liberal, things have really changed for the worse.
I mean, absolutely, and the problem at this point reflects itself in so many different things. It's not coincidental that the places with the most highest level of public sector unionization not only have a higher debt on average, they have more. They rank always very high in terms of regulation and very high in terms of taxation. All these things are related. I get in debates a lot with people, and people will tell me things like, oh, you know, you talk about tax rates and people leaving states. And a lot of these advocates or a lot of these academics will say, well, but people don't never leave just because of taxes. There's, you know, there's quality of life. There's all these reasons. One thing I point out to them is, you're right. They don't. Well, many people don't leave just because of taxes. But taxes are a marker for something else. They are a marker for a philosophy of government, big government, that also includes heavy regulation, a lot of limitations on growth, including, zoning restrictions and stuff like that. And when you put them all together, they get in the way of economic enrichment.
Well, on that point, I was fascinated in looking back at your earlier work. You wrote a book, maybe 2005, titled The New Left.
The New
Left. Yes.
The New Left.
That, well, that's right. Exactly. That's what I'd like you to talk about, because what I've been saying here, I've been using that phrase New Left. It's a radical left now. I don't think their policy positions represent, certainly not more than a third of the country, maybe 25%. But they've been powerful enough to win the election nationally, control certain states, because they've got allies in the press, big tech, the schools, so they've taken over the educational system, and increasingly even the national security establishment. So they've got power way beyond their numbers. And they are radical. I mean, they don't believe in free speech. They have all those attributes that you just described. And that's what's got to be defeated. It's they're small in numbers, but boy, they've got really good allies. I mean, do you think the dominant influence on the left differs in character from when you wrote that book in 2005?
Absolutely. What I was seeing, and if you look at the introduction, there's a kind of I go through a list of these different groups, and public sector unions are high up on the list. But I was talking about a lot of other groups that were essentially working on what we now call identity politics. It was all about identity politics with them. I never imagined that would come to represent what we see today. But I was talking about New York City a little while ago. Well, why are we now starting to see this decline in New York City after this, 20 to 25 years of just stability? One reason is because the Democratic Party has shifted wildly to the left as it's gotten younger, because the younger people entering the party and younger people moving to places like New York City are increasingly progressive, not just liberal, but progressive. New York City is a good example. If you look at the progressive, we have something called the Democratic Socialists of America. If you look at the Democratic Socialists of America who are being elected in New York City, AOC is a perfect example. She's the number one example, but she had them being elected to the city council, to the state legislature. They are being elected in neighborhoods that gentrified. They're not being elected in poor neighborhoods. They're being elected in gentrifying neighborhoods by young people. But as a result of that, we've seen this tremendous shift to the left. And so we've gone from You know, I always said about New York City, the reason New York City was able to reverse its decline was because a substantial part of the middle class stayed in New York City. They left a lot of cities. We know this, right? They left a lot of cities. I grew up in Newark, New Jersey. The middle class left Newark, New Jersey. Detroit, the middle class left those places. And as a result of that, there weren't necessarily voters voting for reform. In New York City, they stayed. And a lot of those, you know, even public sector employees, they couldn't take the violence. And at some point, you know, they voted for reform. We've lost that part of the Democratic Party. When Rudy Giuliani took over office in New York, there were so few Republicans in New York City that he had to staff his administration with a lot of Democrats. But they were all Democrats who they wanted change because they knew this, they couldn't live like that. I don't see those Democrats anymore. And frankly, a lot of old Democrats I know from places like New York City, who were part of the Koch administration and then later the Giuliani administration, are just not part of this Democratic Party anymore. And that is this really the signature change. And it's really affected the public sector unions. Another place we've seen a real division is that private sector unions still tend to be less radical. And particularly in the trades, they tend to be pro-growth, because without economic growth, really, there's nothing, right? If you look at what places like San Francisco and Los Angeles and now New York are doing, for instance, to shut down new economic development, chasing Amazon out of New York City after it decided to go to Queens, that drives these public sector unions crazy. And in fact, so I wrote a piece for the Wall Street Journal a little while ago about New York City, talking about this face-off between the public sector unions and the progressives and socialists and the private sector unions. And that's kind of a defining characteristic right now. But really, the problem is that our public sector unions aren't just liberal anymore, and they're not just fighting for their pensions anymore. They are driving us in the direction of a kind of race-based, identity-based politics, which is, you know, destructive to not just our budgets, but our school systems and our public safety.
Well, that's a great segue into the other area that's a real mess, especially in Chicago, and that's, you know, crime and policing. And, you know, you've written a recent article about the flash mobs, and, you know, anybody who's following Chicago right now knows not just about the murders. There were 1,000 murders in Cook County in 2021, but then you've got these massive number of carjackings. And much of that has been by a lot of the change in how we do policing, and also in terms of how we prosecute or don't prosecute, or raising things like levels of what constitutes a felony. So I think right along those lines, tell us what you're seeing there. And obviously Chicago fits right in with the problems you're talking about.
Yeah, and it is a little bit mystifying. I mean, it's not all that mystifying. We know, for instance, that there's been a concerted effort by people like George Soros and others to elect very, very liberal prosecutors and district attorneys where they are electable, and that's created problems everywhere. I thought to myself that I could understand this in New York, because crime got so low in New York that people who hadn't lived here during the 80s or the early 90s came here and thought, you know, we don't have to be policing like this anymore. And so I wasn't shocked at that. But in a place like Chicago, that really, I mean, crime kind of declined, but Chicago has been near the top of the list in terms of murder rates and violent crime rates for quite a long time. I was very surprised to see that. And it's a real disconnection, if you will, from reality. And unfortunately, there's a lot of that going, you know, that we see in San Francisco is another good example. Philadelphia is a very good example. City with a lot of economic problems, high crime rate, and they elect an extremely, extremely, you know, liberal, progressive district attorney. And crime is through the roof there. The federal prosecutors are stepping in and trying to actually prosecute people for federal crimes just to stem some of the tide in there. So it's very disturbing, you know, but here's the difference. And in a way it's frustrating, but maybe it will make a difference. When crime rose in the 70s and the 80s, there were all kinds of crazy ideas of why it rose. And there was no plan. because there was no precedent for what we were seeing. We and others began promoting things, this, you know, these different kinds of policing, especially what was called broken windows policing. It took a long time to convince people because this hadn't really been done. But we had some really great people behind it, including the eminent political scientist James Q. Wilson and George Kelling, the famous criminologist. And eventually we instituted that and we saw the results. What's disheartening now is we know what works. We know, and I said this in the retailing piece, that if you don't police, if you let the little crimes go by, and this is what a lot of new age prosecutors are talking about. You know, why do we have to prosecute quality of life crimes? Why do we have to hold people accountable for things like fare jumping in the subways? Because we know that if you don't prosecute that, it doesn't stop there. It doesn't stop with shoplifting. Half of the states have raised the limit at which we consider shoplifting to be a felony. It, as a result, making it a misdemeanor up to $1,000 or more. As they raised the limits, shoplifting exploded. Why did it explode? Because if you let a misdemeanor go by again and again and again, it doesn't stop. It becomes something worse. Now we not only have shoplifting, we have shoplifting gangs, and we have violence in stores because of shoplifting, because it doesn't go in the other direction. And the only thing I can say is that because we do have a template, because we do know what worked last time, maybe we're getting a reaction in this country faster than we did in the 70s and the 80s. Even the president is talking in the State of the Union about how we can't defund the police. That's not a small that's not a small victory, right? So we'll see.
One other particular on crime I'd like your opinion on, you know, stop and frisk, famously.
Right.
Giuliani used it very aggressively.
Bloomberg used it.
Can't do it now because it's unconstitutional. Are we stuck without a critical tool, or how important is that, do you think?
Well, here's the thing. There was a case in New York, and the judge, who was so biased that the appellate court actually removed her from the case, ruled that this was unconstitutional. The case, Bloomberg appealed the case, and the case was on appeal and was going up to the Supreme Court. And then de Blasio was elected and just dropped the case and dropped stop and frisk. So we'll have to see. It hasn't been finally tested. The thing is, even Bill Bratton, who was the first commissioner of New York City during the reform era, the reform Giuliani era, and then went out to Los Angeles and also cut crime there, even he says that you can move beyond stop and frisk without essentially giving up quality of life policing. And there are methods of doing this. So we haven't completely given up. The thing is, what stop and frisk was all about was getting the guns off the street. And the idea was if you had reasonable suspicion, you would stop people and search them. And that's how they confiscated a lot of guns. And in the process of confiscating those guns, they found that the people who were illegally carrying guns were wanted on other charges a lot of the time. That shouldn't be shocking to anybody, right? And that's essentially, you know, there's a small minority of people who create a crime as we know it because they are repeat offenders, right? And that's the problem. Now we're no longer putting those repeat offenders in jail. The first thing to do is to make sure if someone has a record of violent crime and they've been arrested and they are out on bail for something else, that they don't get let out again. This is what is happening in a lot of these places with these progressive prosecutors. We have so many stories about people doing really, really terrible things and murders after they're out on bail with a history of violent crime and with a recent arrest. And in shoplifting, it's absurd. In New York City, I mentioned in this piece I did, right? There's a guy who was arrested in 2021, 47 times for shoplifting, never put in jail, released on bail every time. He would be released on bail and go out and sometimes be arrested twice in the same day. 47 times. At some point, you have to say it's no longer a misdemeanor.
You wrote a fascinating piece last year on free speech entrepreneurs. And this topic, I think, is critical to the exactly the question you raised earlier about why do voters continue to vote the way they do. I think we all know that much of the media doesn't cover things objectively, and big tech platforms suppress things. We've had a partial solution in the pop-up of all these new platforms, you know, Rumble for video,
Substack.
Yeah, Substack is, you know, really, we got some of the hottest journalists in the country are now on Substack, and I think people are writing them. But the question is, are they working? I mean, are voters going to those sources? And where this question came most particularly, I think, clear is on the debate about COVID mitigations and masking and all the rest. We clearly still have a lot of people that read only the mainstream media. They are totally unaware of the dissenting voices out there in the debate on these things. You have, Google was suppressing the phrase Great Barrington Declaration. That's one of the largest, you know, very reputable group of dissenters. So I'm uncertain about whether people are being reached through these other means. You wrote that article about a year ago. What's your updated view on?
I mean, here's the point. For every once in a while, I kind of like remind myself that I started out as a kind of financial free market journalist. And what really struck me here back when I wrote this piece, and it's advancing very quickly since then, is that you had all these alternate platforms starting up and people were going to them. And most of them started up not because they wanted to be free speech outlets. They started up because they saw an opportunity, because they saw that the mainstream media had a grip, if you will, a financial grip even, on information. But there were so many people who wanted a voice, and they, all these entrepreneurs, decided they could make money doing this, right? And so it was a reaction to I guess you could say, the financial grip that the mainstream media had on information. But the theory was, people want a voice. We hear this voice. Now, if you look at Substack, that's a good example. The numbers are incredible. You have people like Barry Weiss, who was on the editorial page of the New York Times, but was a conservative there, and finally wrote a letter to the publisher saying, I have to leave here because like I'm being harassed. But she's a conservative at the same time, although I think she's just really a social liberal, you know, but she's a conservative in a lot of others. But at the same time, you had a lot of traditional liberals. I mean, guys like Matt Iglesias from Vox. Yep. And
Glenn Greenwald.
Yeah, obviously Glenn Greenwald and Yasha Monk, the political scientist. And they were all saying they couldn't say things, writing for places like The Atlantic and other, that they couldn't say things that they want. Andrew Sullivan, another good example, right? They all went to Substack and their numbers went through the roof. I mean, I think Barry Weiss is something like 250,000 paid subscribers that are sending her a couple of bucks every month. The numbers are through the roof. Same Matt Iglesias, it's in the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands. So it's clearly demonstrating there's a need out there. At the same time, it's hard to say that the mass market is really a mass market anymore, because it's certainly not the mass market that I grew up with. There were CBS, NBC, and ABC, right? And there was the New York Times, and then there was your local newspaper. So the mainstream media has really been, to a certain extent, I won't say defanged, but they are clearly being undermined. But there is a core of people who, as you say, will only read them. But there's such an alternative view. And all you have to do is look at all of these medical and doctors and medical academics and biologists who took another point of view and, you know, wanted to fight and contend against the CDC and and these guys, you know, they were trying to cancel them, and they found their own outlets. And I think that the average person now, I mean, people who are stuck with the kind of old pandemic, you know, reality out there, even though, you know, that's really fading fast now. I think there's a whole, you know, a whole alternate argument that a lot of people, that reached a lot of people through these other outlets. Still a long, long way to go, but we've got these technological innovations that's rapidly changing the environment.
So would you, for example, say that we don't need a new antitrust approach to breaking them up in order to allow easier competition against those big ones?
You know, I have to say that's one of the most complex questions, because we're talking about a new level of competition, different kinds of competition. For the time being, at least, I think that they are actually undermining themselves more and more, because the problem is they can't satisfy even the people they think are on their side, because eventually something happens which puts them on the other side. There's no answer. I think the real problem they have is their model just doesn't really work economically. And over time, that's going to be a huge problem for them. I mean, Twitter still, I don't think, makes money. I don't think it works economically, but we'll have to see. We have had a tremendous debate within the Institute, and we have a lot of, you know, people who are very libertarian leaning. And they are, their default is that we shouldn't be regulating, and that we shouldn't be suppressing free speech, but that includes, you know, letting those folks do what they want to do because it's their business. Unless we get more evidence, particularly evidence, let's say, that they are using some of their technological skill or technological power to suppress the new platforms that I've talked about, you know, unless we see evidence of that, I tend to think let's just let you know, our platforms fight their way through this, you know. But there are problems again, like, for instance, Amazon having its own Amazon having like a lot of the cloud, if you will. And they do a lot of cloud computing services that people don't understand, and hosting. And when Amazon starts taking conservative websites offline, that's a problem, right? Because now what they're doing is, you know, they're not just moderating their own content. They're saying, you know, we're not going to allow you to use our systems. And we, you know, and if we dominate this marketplace, then we have to start asking, you know, do we need some kind of antitrust law to make sure that the channels remain open?
Well, Steve, we need to close up. So I think it might be a good moment to get your closing thoughts. We have elections in November. We have something called Amendment 1, which is going to be on the ballot, and that will enshrine the collective bargaining powers and bargaining rights into the Constitution. So that's something that, you know, Mark and I strongly oppose, obviously. You mentioned all the negative things that are going on in Illinois. What advice do you give listeners about engagement, about the future, how to fight this? Optimism, pessimism? Do we have to crash first? What are your final thoughts here?
Right, the worse the better. So the first thing is, what's going to happen? And people are very focused, not surprisingly, on the congressional elections. And I think that's going to be a really defining moment. But at the same time, we're going to see change at the state level. And, you know, we're going to see, you know, we already saw Glenn Youngkin sweep his way into power in Virginia. We're going to see more change. And that change is going to lead to even more competitive state policies in other states around the country, aimed at places like Illinois, not aimed specifically at Illinois, although there probably will be a new level, you know, a new round of ads in Illinois saying, you know, come to Texas. You know, there'll probably be more of that. But we're going to see more of that. I have a feeling we almost saw change in New Jersey, too. That governor's race was much closer than people thought. I have a feeling that states like Illinois are just too much of a, the powers are too entrenched right now. But last time around, we saw several levels of reform. It started in 2010, but it kept going through 2016 and 2018. And I think it kept going because people in states that didn't get reformed the first time around saw what was going on, and they got it the second time around. And all you have to do is look at the lack of progress Illinois is making on things like pensions. I mean, it's absurd. The stock market, even with the recent decline in the stock market in the last 5 years has been just up by 120%. And the funding level in Illinois hasn't changed. I mean, if it hasn't changed, you know, based on that, when is it ever going to change? So I think what's going to happen is we're going to see several rounds of reform, and the places that are most resistant are going to come second.
Steve, just fantastic historical perspective you've given to us. And listeners, read City Journal besides Wire Points, and look for Steve Malanga's articles in particular. Thanks so much for joining us, Steve. Really, really helpful.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.